you for joining us again on another episode of That Guy's Mom. We are here today with That Guy's Mom, Ann Mayer. You can find out so much more about this at www.themattmayerstory.com. I'm Scott Durbin. I get to co-host here with Ann. And Ann, we have another great guest today, don't we?
Absolutely. We have another surprise guest, and it is That Guy once again. But today's show, we really want to dwell on a lot of the questions. People had been listening to Matt's former interview on this show, and you know, a lot of people want him to speak more in the theme of our show, which has to do with really overcoming adversity. And our show's mission has always been about encouraging people, regardless of where they stand in life. And we've taken a look at the good, the bad, and the ugly. We've sought a verse that is about making beauty from ashes, and it is the desire for us to seek hope through our faith in Christ. So today's theme is going to be about how to get through tragedy. And Matt, are you there on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, we know hindsight's 20/20, and it's sometimes hard to review an event without it being tainted by time. But Matt, today we want to talk a little bit about taking you back 4 years ago. To the best of your ability, can you take us back to your mindset moments after you found out that someone had been killed in a fatal drunk driving accident?
That moment in this time right now still seems surreal. I still have a hard time wrapping my mind around those words. And to know that I was responsible for the death of another man is something that is hard to chew on. And, you know, recently I did another interview and the same question came up, and you take us back. And it wasn't until after the interview that I realized that going back to those exact emotions is almost impossible. But after the interview got done, I came up with a word. I said, wow, the best way I can explain the feelings is emotional nausea. And in that time, I couldn't control those emotions. They would come to the surface when I was by myself, and the thought process of somebody's life lost, I'm going to prison, it didn't seem normal. I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And I think the emotions that gripped me in that time period of my life were debilitating, in a sense, because I felt like I was in no man's land. I felt like I had no purpose. I knew that the ramifications were prison. But deeper than that, the consequences on the surface that man's law dictates, they meant absolutely nothing compared to the pain that I knew. I called it innocent family. And I don't think people understand that the pain that is caused to Port Cap's family and my very own family far outweighed any type of selfish pain that I may have had. So every time I thought about somebody died because of my ignorance and my recklessness, that emotional nausea came up. And I would say the only thing that's changed since 4 years ago isn't the surreal feelings behind it, and it's not even that I've grown past that pain. I think I've only learned to control it. I can't contain it, and as I brought up the recent interview I did, it came up. That monster came to the surface, and not out of control, weeping, but sobbing to a point where it was hard to speak. I had to regain my composure. And I think it's only been this time dealing with self that I was able to contain that emotional nausea. But like throw up, it comes up, and there's really nothing you can do about it.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. So the sustenance through the ensuing months leading up to court and all of that, where was your spiritual mindset?
Well, having faith as my default, which means I grew up in a Christian household, went to Christian school, stayed in devotions, knew the word, practiced Christianity. It was only after tragedy in 2005 that I had experiential knowledge of Christianity, which meant I had to go through the loss of my older brother and experience God's grace, his peace, and it was that faith that was activated through that pain. So fast forward 4 years into my very own tragedy and finding the same sustenance, the same stability through my faith, and I think it had nothing to do with my actual everyday routine and everything to do with this default faith I built up through the years, having a foundation. And it says, when them storms come, and they will come, what do you fall back on? And I think that, you know, my family and you, Mom, can attest that when you get slain, when you get rocked, you aren't all there in your thought process, but if you've built up that foundation all those years, that's what you fall back on. And it's almost as if that time period from the accident, March 7th, 2009, to today, almost 2013, March, it's like, it's a blur.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blur thinking of, how did I get through? And the only possible answer to explain how can somebody respond to the pain they caused is God's grace and His peace. And it was something that I didn't deserve, but it's something that God freely gives. And if you can learn to just accept it and not drown yourself in your own thought process, drown yourself in your own pain. And I said that before. I think that's very selfish. You know, when you do something or even something is done to you and you want to wallow in that pain, instead of saying, you know what, let me try to think clearly and allow God's grace to at least cover me for the day. Because I couldn't think past the day. I couldn't think past what I had done in that time period. Seeing in the front windshield of your life, prison, and regardless of having people come by and telling you this is what prison's like and this is what to expect, you still can't see it.
Right.
So you're in no man's land. And it's not that I had no hope. It's just that the future that I was looking at was set into a stone. It was just, it's extremely hard to even explain, you know, for somebody I like to explain that doesn't have that same noose hanging around their neck, for them not to actually experience the grip of this type of pain, nobody will ever understand it.
Right. You know, one of the things that you said about the default, I think when I look at your life as a mom, I see all the seeds that were present and planted. But it took a torrential rain to grow those seeds. And I think that could explain your default, which I guess is those that are listening, we always stress how important it is to have the right foundation through the Word of God. But Matt, where did the Psalm 46:10, be still and know that I'm God? You started that fairly early in the crisis with leaving messages, I know, to me, and you would sign your name, Be Still.
Yeah, I think that just came through probably one of the devotionals I read in that time period, that dark time period, and it stuck. And it was almost as if saying, you know, be still, just relax. I know what you did, I know what you're going through. And God was telling me, I have this under control. So I'm going to need you to just still yourself in this time period and allow me to set the stage or prepare things. Yeah, the point being is God never purposes harm to accomplish His good.
Right.
But He'll use what we did to fix and bring His good out of that harm.
Absolutely. And one of the things that He immediately did was He gave you an opportunity through no initiative of any of us to speak to students about this incident. And in fact, the first person to ask you to speak was Don Chu from Bible Club. And I remember that conversation with you. And in fact, the reporter talked to me about that the other night, and I told him how I was appalled by the suggestion. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I do actually remember the request. I remember that it was, I believe, less than a month after the accident, so everything was extremely fresh. And the fact that he even saw a platform for me to speak to the kids obviously was honorable because of what he saw that I stood for, regardless of the tragedy. But being in the midst of it, you, my mom, and our family, we obviously were taken back because it was too fresh. The wound was still seeping. The wound was still extremely wide open. And for me to put my face back out there to say anything to the kids, I mean, it would have been a very heavy, heavy thing to even consider. But I do remember that we sat back and we basically were still in the sight of God. We put that verse into effect and allowed His peace to kind of push me out into that light. And I think that if I didn't do that first speaking engagement, I would have stayed in that darkness. And it was almost as if God gave me an opportunity to teach the kids a lesson, not saying, hey, go this way, try this. No, I simply sat in front of them and said, this is what I was, this is who I am, and this is what I did. And all I wanted you to know is do not take your decisions lightly and to guard each decision.
One of the things I remember was when I had told you about that phone call, it was on the machine, and you said you were going to pray about it, and then you came downstairs and you said, I'm going to do it, which frankly floored me. And you said, I thought about it and prayed about it, and I figured if I stand in front of my former peers in the good, then I should in the bad. And I do believe that, and I think that was a defining moment, again, of surrendering, humility, you know, putting pride aside, and that God does use those opportunities to bless when we do that.
Yeah, I believe so. Once again, I do remember praying about it, and I do remember feeling led to speak out about it because the opportunity was presented. So the difference maker is I didn't seek any of those opportunities to speak out. And the other difference maker is responsibility and accountability are different, but they go hand in hand. So being responsible was, yeah, I did that, and now I have to go through the court system, the legal ramifications, and the prison time. But the accountability part comes into saying, hey, I have a message, or I have an experience that may help other people. So it was never about me. It was putting the message out there saying, do not do what I did. Do not take life for granted. Do not think that because you have everything set in stone and you're academically sound and you are that guy in the community or whatever your background may be, that each and every decision that you may make plays a part to your future. The smallest.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
The smallest to the largest. And I thought that if I was seen doing good all those years, that the same people that looked up to me when I was doing good needed to see me at my worst, and they needed to hear my voice, that I was owning up to something that I had done, in hope that they don't go down that route.
Very interesting. Matt, we're going to end this call for now and have you call back,
okay.
And we're going to pick up on a few more questions.
All right.
Okay. Okay, Matt. We are back on the phone. That is one of the dilemmas and hardships of prison. You only get so much time, and you're calling us back, and we had a few more questions for you. We were talking about the message that you were enabled to present, basically through the South Jersey Traffic Safety Alliance, and you spoke to 7,000 kids in just a matter of a few months, I recall. Can you tell us what was most surprising about how the students responded?
You know, going into all these different schools, a lot of the kids initially responded to me before they even heard my message, before they even knew my story, with attentiveness because I could relate to them in the age difference. So instead of having grown-ups come in or somebody in a suit or even cops come in presenting whatever, whether it be traffic, whether it be sex education, whether it be drunk driving stories, automatically the kids were interested. What does this young kid have to say to us? So before I even began most of these assemblies, I had positioned myself to, you know, mess around with a couple of the kids in different groupings. Sometimes I even sat in the auditorium seats with them, and when I would stand up to be the guest speaker, they were already curious, what is he about to say? And as I began introing my life and telling them who I was and where I've been and the things that I accomplished, they were automatically interested because I believe that a lot of them could see themselves in me. The way I presented myself, I believe the athletes saw themselves in me, and even the academics. And as the program would continue and they realized that I'm going somewhere with my message, it was almost as if you could hear a hush and silence. And that's almost an oxymoron, to hear a hush or a silence go over the crowd. That's how captivating it was. It had nothing to do with me, and it had everything to do with the way the message was presented. So I remember several times that I could feel that emotional nausea rising up within me, and had it not been for the hundreds of kids present or however many were in the auditorium at those times, it would have gotten the better of me. But beautifully, there was a break during each assembly, and the break was to show the news video from the accident. This would give me an opportunity to walk off to the side of the stage, and it was during that time, and I didn't learn this until after the first several presentations, that I would have to kneel down and pray. Because the first few times that I actually watched the newscast talk about me and my accident and what I had caused, I would break down. And coming back to present myself to the kids was a very difficult thing to do, because that's when the presentation picked up pace, began to talk about feelings and emotions and pain. And heck with prison. You think that's something? Think about this, that you were responsible for taking somebody's life, and that's a prison sentence for the rest of your life. So I learned that I had to go off to the side and be still. Be still and know that I'm God. It would continually ring in my heart that as I came back and presented myself, my emotions were clear. But you could still see my remorse. You could see that I was wearing my heart on my sleeve. But it was during that time period before prison that I learned to control it. Once again, the emotional nausea can't be contained. It will rise, but I've learned to control it. And I've learned to use it and turn it into a passion. And I think that's what Rick Warren wrote in his book. God allows pain into our lives because we are spiritually complacent. And therefore, pain is that fuel that jumpstarts our passion.
Right. And one of the things I remember when I spoke with one of the students, when I had to do an interview with some of the students you had spoken to after you were sentenced, and one of the boys said that one of the most compelling things for him was that he had an idea of what a drunk driver looked like, and you didn't look like it.
Yeah, you know what? It's so crazy, because the way it's portrayed, this crime, it's crazy to say, but I don't know, I'm saying it because this is the truth, because I see it from this side of the wall. The child molesters and the pedophilers aren't looked at in the same light as a drunk driver who is classified as a murderer. And it's crazy because I even read newspaper clippings before I was ever in trouble about people that kill people drunk driving. And I'll say, how the heck, like, what is that person's problem? How can they do that? And now I'm that drunk driver, so now I realize, wow, the thought process is entirely different than what everybody would think. And you could just be an everyday all-American kid, and you make one decision to take a sip of alcohol, which diminishes your judgment, and then you don't have a sound mind thought process going on. So what you're doing, you don't even realize you're doing, and before you know it, you're standing on the side of the road at a wreck, being arrested, and then you find out hours later that you took somebody's life.
Right.
And you're the furthest thing from a murderer, because you had no intention. It was accidental. As much as people say you knew what you're doing, you don't. And it's crazy, because if you're under the influence of alcohol and you sign a contract, that contract is void, because they say you do not have the capacity and thought to make a conscious decision on contract paper. Yet, when it comes to getting in the vehicle, they say you know exactly what you're doing. And that's wrong, because I did not know what I was doing. It does not excuse my actions. It does not excuse my recklessness. And it does not excuse the responsibility factor that I should have planned properly before even touching.
Right. I think that's what the main point is for the drunk driving dialogue today, and that is pre-drink, pre-alcohol, you make that decision. But I understand exactly what you're saying there. I want to move forward a little bit. What did you make of your sentencing day? Were you nervous about going to prison?
I was not nervous about going to prison. The place of prison did not make me fearful. I've always been a very outgoing kid, always had a different type of personality where I'd get along in any type of setting, any group of people. The place of prison, actually, from seeing it depicted on TV, from hearing people that have done time that were coming out of the woodworks to explain prison to me, COs in the family, COs of friends, corrections officers that explained what prison's like, that stuff didn't move me one bit. The only thing that moved me on sentencing day was the fact that I had to betray myself to the family of my victim. That was all I worried about from day one, was what was I going to say to them? How are they going to receive me? Can I share my heart clearly with clarity and not lose it, or have this emotional nausea take over anything that I wanted to present to them? And I just remember several days before sentencing, that's all I wanted to know was a speech, but I don't care if I knew that thing like the back of my hand. In the moment, as you're looking at the family that you caused pain to, that speech goes out the water. And I did have notes in front of me, but the feelings and the thoughts that I had expressed came directly from the heart. And I think part of the healing process for me was getting those words out, because I had already written a letter to them, but being able to speak it to them in their presence was part of the healing process. And as the court day unfolded, and Court Cap's oldest son actually forgave me in the open, I believe the healing process was progressed even further. And I think that the weight of the world that I had held within me up until that point was completely lifted. And then the place of prison, it was more of a peaceable thought that I can get to come here, get my mind right, humble myself in the sight of God, and discipline and learn self-control, something that I technically didn't have in spite of what everybody thought I had. Which was scary in itself, because you can look at me and say, wow, he's so self-controlled, he's so disciplined, how did this happen? And yeah, this is all true, but I was complacent with my self-control and complacent with my discipline. So my discipline may have been taking me to places of success or accomplishing different things, yet God knew that there was so much more inside of me that I failed to unlock because of complacency and being set in my ways and being comfortable with life and thinking nothing could go wrong.
And that spiritual vacuum of complacency is dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. So it was a place of prison that, outside of that, dealing with the pain, outside of facing Horcap's family, the place of prison was almost like a comfort zone to get away from everything. So there was no fear involved. There was more of an anxiousness to jumpstart this process. And, you know, contrary to what popular opinion thinks about prison and even leaving prison, I'm taking with me a life sentence. You can put me here for 5, 10, 20 years. I'm still leaving here with the thought of what I did to be here. And all that this time period has done for me, under God's good graces, is fixed me. It's fixed me emotionally, it's fixed me mentally, and it's given me a passion spiritually that I would have never had I not gone through those tragedies.
Okay, and I just want to clarify, under God's good graces, because you, and I know you know this because you write about it, prison isn't fixing anything. It's the time isolated that you've taken to grow intimately with God. And I'd like to one day do a show about just some of the realities of prison, because we certainly don't want any kids listening to this and thinking that, you know, prison is a respite.
Right, absolutely. This place is a beast. I don't ever want to come across and say this place is easy. You can lock me up in a mansion. You can lock anybody up in a comfortable setting. And the fact that you can't leave when you want to leave makes it a prison. And this place will tear you up if you don't have a foundation. Your mind can get the best of you. You are helpless in this place. If you have no hope and you have no vision and you have no purpose, this place will eat you alive. I've seen stronger men with stronger willpower, with more mental toughness than me, completely break down within day one and week one of incarceration. And I learned from the very beginning that it's that exact day that you decide that this place isn't going to break you, or that exact day that you decide this place is too much for you to handle, that dictates your entire time. And some of these guys will live with defeat from day one because they came in and they were broke, and they do it all their time, days, weeks, months, and years, multiple years, completely defeated. And what the sad thing is that there's no rehabilitation, there's no programs that will fix that mindset. So all you have is a dead man walking. And what he does is he leaves here more defeated, more depressed, and more discouraged than when he first got here. And what does he do? He trajects and projects his pain and guilt on the world.
Right.
And that's why the recidivism rate is so high. So I don't want anybody to ever think this is easy. This is probably this is extremely hard.
Right.
The environment's hard. The mentalities are hard. It's what you bring to each day that sets you apart from the attitude of your environment.
Now, I know we don't have much time, so I'm going to throw one last question, which will probably be our wrap-up question for this show. What would you say to anybody who right now is in the throngs of a tragedy or a failure?
Oof. I think that I was just recently studying a verse that's in Romans 8. That's where I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us. And obviously that goes for somebody that has faith. But even your faith can be rocked when you're going through a tragedy. And I think that the most important thing to understand is it gets greater later. And when you can keep your hope alive, no matter what you're going through, no matter how foggy or blinding that tragedy may seem, that when you have your hope of heaven or your hope that it's going to get better, and that God, if you believe in God, that he controls all things and that he works all things out for the good when you love him, that you can literally humble yourself in that time frame, in that tragedy, that loss, that divorce, that depression, whatever that may be, and understand that God is doing it for your good. He desires our character development. He desires us to build spiritual muscle. He desires for our faith to grow. And I think that no matter how hard it may be and how tough the resistance, when you have that mindset with just a little bit of hope, that's all it takes to get up from your circumstances and to see light. And I think that, you know, one of the hardest things for an inmate to understand with that concept is that there really is no light at the end of the tunnel when you first arrive at prison. So it's got to be a cultivated thought process that knows that it just gets greater later as time goes on. And unfortunately, not a lot of people will buy into that.
We have 60 seconds remaining.
Regardless of their background and faith. And you can tell somebody with certainty that you've already gone through it, and you can tell them with certainty of heart that if you just have some faith, God will hear you, He will answer you. But the sad thing is, a lot of people, like, I don't want to sound too harsh, they become so caught up in their own feelings and their own pity that they refuse or cannot see.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
That God allowed that tragedy to get their attention.
Well, Matt, you're a living example of that, and I know we're going to be disconnected. We thank you for being our guest today, and we hope to do another show soon.
All right, thank you for having me, and I will speak to you soon as well.
Okay.
Bye.
And we concluded our interview with Matt, and we never want to end a show without offering our verse that we rely so heavily on through trials, and that is Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God.